This is an Enterprise Time Security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Chris Eng, Chief Research Officer of Veracode.
Hi, Chris Eng, Chief Research Officer. My responsibility here at Veracode is I run the team that builds the security knowledge into our products, so defining kind of the rule sets and techniques that our products use to find vulnerabilities. And then I'm also responsible for making sure that our own products are secure. In a sense, dealing with a lot of the same problems and challenges that our customers deal with on a daily basis, using products, figuring out how to incorporate security testing into our daily work.
I'll take that second part of your job first. If we look around the industry, the software industry per se doesn't have a great reputation for the quality of its products over the last 30 years. How do you change that story? How do you make sure the products that leave here are better than they would have been 2 years, 5 years, 10 years ago?
A lot of it, what we're finding lately is getting more touch points with developers. If you're going back 20 years or even further, the historical way of doing things was bolt-on security at the end, get your product ready, now have it tested by security for a couple weeks, and then you come back with a report, which nobody has time to fix all the things in it, and then you ship anyway, and maybe you knock out a few of those issues, and then maybe a year later you come back and test it again. That's the way things were working in 2000 when I first got into the consulting side of things. You do a pen test, maybe you would do a retest, and you'd come back later. Nobody learns anything from that. They fix the thing that you told them to fix, maybe, and then they forget about it till the next time you come back. So there's no lessons learned. There's no feedback loop. And so over the years, what we've learned is that, it seems obvious, but the more that you can get in front of the developer, the more that you can drive those lessons home. You're just trying to create habits. You're trying to create habits where they understand what good code looks like, what bad code looks like. And so as we get to trying to be in their faces all the time, we're in the IDE. We're in the continuous integration pipeline. We're at every touch point. So whenever they make a mistake, for example, we can tell them right then and there, hey, you just introduced a cross-site scripting error. Here's how to fix it. And they can fix it right then. And hopefully over time, they stop making those mistakes. We're really only getting to that point recently because I think DevOps has really created the environment for that. Things are moving so quickly and there's this need for automation and there's very little tolerance for things that take a long time. And so quick feedback loops and quick prescriptive advice to developers is something that seems to be working. We've been going for a couple decades now and we're still seeing the same types of mistakes being made, so there's a long way to go.
But changing that is also about culture. You mentioned cross-site scripting. You could easily have mentioned SQL injection. Neither of those are new. They've been around for a decade, decade and a half, yet we still make those mistakes. Is it a failure of training? Is it a failure of culture? Is it a failure of tooling? What is it that means we've been unable to factor out something we've known about for so long?
If I go to college and get a computer science degree, there's very little chance that I will ever learn what a SQL injection vulnerability looks like. There's a few programs that are starting to incorporate security, but they're the exceptions rather than the rule. I come out of college with a 4-year degree. I can be hired into a company. I've never been trained on how to avoid these things. And then I get tasked with creating some feature for some website or some product that the company is creating. The user story for that feature describes all the functional requirements that it has to conduct, but there's no security requirements in there. It says, make the form do this, but it doesn't say, and also do it in a way that avoids these types of attacks. There's functional requirements, but there's no security requirements. And then later on, somebody dings me for making a mistake that I was never taught how to avoid, and I was not told to avoid in the course of doing my job. There is a failure there on the educational side. We can't expect people to just know stuff that we didn't teach them. We expect them to know about algorithms, and if we didn't teach that. They come in, they have very little exposure to training. A lot of the training is still very kind of slideware focused, and take this course once, pass a quiz at the end, now you know everything you need to know. So there's no reinforcement. Again, there's no feedback loop. So there's a lot of things culturally that should be getting done within the organization to teach developers the basics, to specify actually what they need to be doing, you know, to drive the right behaviors. And then we need to reinforce that. We need to have various activities that drive home the point. One of the best things you can do is demonstrate to a developer what the attack looks like from the offensive side. If you've ever demonstrated a SQL injection vulnerability for a developer and then watched their face as the credit cards come rolling out on the screen, that's the light bulb moment. Now they understand why they're being asked to parameterize their database inputs. Before, it's just like, okay, well, it's just a rule to follow. But now they understand why. And so I think there needs to be more of that, kind of connecting one side to the other.
Why do you think education has suffered in this sense? Because if we look at the attackers, they're often younger than many of the people who've come out of university. They've got practical skills. They've learned practical skills. The very process they go through makes them problem solvers looking for those issues. What is it that we don't engender? Is it that we try and play too safe with education? Or is it a lack of skilled educators who've actually been attackers or worked within cybersecurity who are brought into those wider computing courses?
Well, I think cybersecurity is changing so quickly, and when you think of a university curriculum, it doesn't change at that pace. You may teach the same course for 5 years or 10 years, because a lot of computer science curriculum really doesn't change. It's the basics. But cybersecurity is changing all the time. Where I've seen successful programs or interesting programs are ones that bring in adjunct faculty, so people that are actually working in the industry to come in and talk about exploit development or reverse engineering or secure coding or whatever the case may be. By doing that, you're getting the state of the art. You're getting what people actually need to know then. So I think it's partly a limitation of the way that courses are developed and delivered in college. The other thing I think is if the big employers out there, like the financial companies or the Facebooks and the Microsofts and everyone hiring developers coming out of college, made it clear that they wanted security in the curriculum, they wanted secure coding in the curriculum, it's just a market force. It's a supply and demand thing. They're not demanding that their college graduates come out with that skill set. If they stopped hiring them because they didn't, and suddenly they hired all the ones that went to schools that did have that in the curriculum, I think those other universities would adjust. It's a theory. But if the employers aren't demanding it, then there's no motivation necessarily for the schools to teach it.
So how do you change that? Because developers end up with you. They don't necessarily have that security mindset to begin with. But you've got to bring them into a culture. You've almost got to re-educate them from a start. How much of a challenge does that make in your educational process to your own staff? And how do you then retain people?
Yeah, once you give them a skill set. Most developers are curious. Most developers do want to learn new stuff. It's an innate curiosity that makes you go into that field to begin with. Same sort of curiosity that gets you into security to begin with. It's slightly different, but it's wanting to understand how things work. I've always found that when you make the training available and you give people time to do these things, no one is trying to create a bad product. They're just doing the best they can with what they know. We do a number of different things internally at Veracode, and we've seen our customers do similar things, but one way that you scale your product security capability is by essentially building security people on the development teams. The typical ratio of application security people to developers is like 1 to 100 at best. I was just at a CISO event earlier today, and a couple people shared what their ratios were, and one of them was 1 to 250. One person can't stretch that far. So what we do is we try to have at least one or two security champions on each development team. They volunteer, which is key, because the last thing you want is somebody doing it begrudgingly. So they volunteer. We do a little boot camp, a couple days, just secure coding fundamentals, security fundamentals. We walk them through some lab exercises. Here's what some of these attacks look like. Here's how you defend against them. And we essentially give them some responsibility and help them understand where the line is. Ultimately, you want to get to a point where they're doing 80% of the security work themselves within their teams, and then they're only escalating that remaining part to the product security team. So that way, that allows you to scale. That type of training, we have office hours every week. We have a Slack channel. We do capture the flag exercises, not ones that we develop ourselves, but just some of the public ones that are out there. And we say, hey, come to this room at this time every week. And if you want to just hack away at some of these exercises, learn a little bit, we'll have someone in there if you get stuck. There's a number of different ways that we can do this. We just acquired this security training company called Hunter 2, and we're calling that Veracode Security Labs now. But what it is it's a cool way of training developers where it's not slideware. It's actually a live instance of like an application where they can go in and they can mess with it. We guide them through the exercises, but they can play with the application, try different things, see if the attacks work, and learn about it in that way. And it's a lot more interactive, and it's a lot more, I think it sticks a lot better when you teach people that way. So I'm really excited about that. We just literally announced that a couple of weeks ago. And so we're in the process of getting all of our security champions and hopefully eventually all of our developers to use that, because I think it'll help some of these concepts stick.
Tooling often falls into two categories. People either think of it as the god that's going to solve everything so that they can just point it and forget it. And in many ways, the cybersecurity industry has been playing that game with AI over the last couple of years. Or it's completely ineffective and it creates a false impression of what it does. You're a company with a lot of tooling. How do you match the tooling to the requirements of your own teams, but also in such a way that it can then be used by customer teams who aren't going to be anywhere near as well educated?
We try to move towards a point where the security tooling is as invisible as possible. That means whenever you can have an analysis happen without a developer having to remember to push a button, you do it. You always work within the systems that the developers are used to using. So you never want to generate a PDF report and give it to somebody and say, okay, look at all these things that we found. Now go manually enter them into your bug tracker and assign them to people. You want scanning to be happening continuously, and you want it to be integrated with the CI tool or the bug tracker or what have you, so that ultimately security bugs are just bugs. They have lots of bugs they're dealing with. You don't want to have a separate system for security. You want everything to be where the developers are working. And so internally, we try to do a lot of that. We try to give them a lot of, if we say like, hey, we want you to run the scan at a particular time in your development process, we give them a little code snippet that says, hey, drop this into your GitLab pipeline. All the stuff you need to happen will happen, minimizing the legwork that they actually have to do. Make it as easy as possible. Working on things like making it visible when a particular project is passing policy or failing policy. Even, you know, something as simple as like a badge that shows up on their repo to make it visible who's doing well or who's doing the best. The competition is always a great aspect. The overall trend is just making it as lightweight as possible and just trying not to hold them back. And that holds with our customers too. Everyone's just trying to innovate faster, build products faster. What we're really trying to do is allow their security teams not to be a bottleneck, to give their developers the confidence to build what they're building at the pace they want to and be confident they're releasing something that's safe.
Going back to the first part of your job role, when you're trying to develop some of the techniques that the tools use, we really have two things we're trying to solve for, don't we? We have the known vulnerabilities, where we have indicators of compromise. And then, to paraphrase a former US president, we have the unknown unknowns. How do you begin to build tools to track that second group? Because that's the danger group.
When we build patterns, rule sets for scanning code, they're usually pretty well-known patterns. You know that SQL injection looks a certain way. You know when there's untrusted data. You know all the different ways that data can come into an application. You know all the different ways that database queries get made. So you connect the dots. You figure out how the data flows through the application. That's where it gets a little bit tricky, because you have to understand the languages and all the different frameworks that are in use and all the connections that may not be immediately obvious, and then how everything fits together in that ecosystem. And so that's primarily what we're doing there. Essentially, everything that we're finding for our customers is a zero day for them, because there is no previous indicator. Like you said, it's a specific pattern that's specific to the code that they're writing that turns up interesting things. And so we try to take kind of every category of flaw that people care about or is impactful and come up with as many different variations on the patterns as we can. And we're constantly going back and refining that. If we get feedback from a customer that we missed something that they found through another tool, that happens. And we'll go back and say, okay, how would we have found this? Is it possible to find this through this particular technology? And can we do so accurately? Because that's the other thing. If you can't do it accurately, then it's just better not to do it. If you write a pattern that spits out false positives all the time, what are developers going to do? They're going to get used to looking at something, saying that's not real, and then disregarding it. And so you're going to train them to disregard everything that comes out of that particular category. There's a balance that we have to find between accuracy and speed and coverage. And what we ultimately aim to do is, you know, provide as much high signal to noise for our customers so that what comes out of there is actionable for them. No tool is going to find everything. You always have to apply multiple techniques. And we put a lot of effort into creating results that are going to be actionable and provide value to the customers.
If everything you find is a zero day for the customer, how do you deal with responsible reporting? Because there are three people here that are affected potentially. The first is the customer who wants a fix now. The second might be a commercial vendor who will want a period of time to check, verify, write a fix before they release it. But that leaves the customer sort of hanging around. The third is the vast amount of open source that we see, where they may not have an obvious contact to talk to, where there is a need to do something because you don't know if they're going to react within 1 month or 3 months or 6 months. And if it's that serious a problem, something has to happen. It creates a complex scenario. What's your process?
If it's the first party, if the issue that we find in the customer's own code, there's not a disclosure process to go through. We obviously have controls on our side to make sure that only the necessary people can see that, and then on their side, the same thing. only the teams that are working on that particular piece of software have access to that application's result set and so on. It's tightly controlled from that aspect. Now, when you have the third-party situation, sometimes we have a large enterprise that wants to do some diligence on the software vendors that they're using. I think you were alluding to that. They reach out to their vendor and say, well, actually, they reach out through us, and they say, hey, we want you to have your software tested by Veracode on this cadence or frequency, and we want you to meet this criteria because you're dealing with a lot of our data and so on. And so we'll conduct that analysis on behalf of the vendor, and the vendor will get the detailed results. The enterprise who requested the scan will get a summary of results. So they know the types of things we found, but they don't know where we found it and like in what file or what it looks like or your line of code. All that detail goes to the vendor so they can fix it. That can facilitate a conversation. Now the enterprise can say to the vendor, well, we want you to fix these many things before we renew the contract or before we hire your company or whatever the case is. The vendor feels good that that level of detail isn't being disclosed to the enterprise who might or might not end up having a relationship with them. They shouldn't have access to all that data. That's managed pretty well. And again, on our side, only the people that need to have contact with it do. And so that's a pretty common use case. The open source one, a lot of what we're doing with open source is we're identifying what components our customers are using, and then we're mapping that against known vulnerabilities that are in the National Vulnerability Database or vulnerabilities that we've identified that may not have a CVE yet, but probably will soon. Those are cases where we're not finding something in the open source component that's previously unknown. We're identifying for the customer that they're using something that's risky. In those cases, not so much of a disclosure issue as much as we just need to notify the customer that they're using a vulnerable version, they need to upgrade to this particular version, file a pull request automatically for that. All the information is already public in that case. It's a known CVE. There may or may not be public exploit data for it. We don't run into those situations where it gets really sticky around disclosure very often at all. I'm really racking my brain to even come up with one. We thought through how that would work from the beginning, and we knew that when we were designing this at the very beginning back in 2007, we had to protect this information very well. We're sitting on a lot of very sensitive information, so it had to be designed from the ground up to just really, really tightly control who would see that. It's worked out pretty well.
You said something really interesting in that answer. You mentioned people who are going to be acquired, customers who want to test an acquisition target's software portfolio. If we think about some of the big cyber breaches we've had, from hotel chains right the way through to other types of commercial organizations, very, very few people do real due diligence on the software portfolio of what they're acquiring. We're sat in the W Hotel, part of Marriott. What caused Marriott the problem was nobody realized what was going on at Starwood. Now, some of that would have come to light had they actually done proper functional testing as part of the acquisition process. How common is that approach starting to be? Are you seeing a significant increase in the number of companies say, look, we've made a bid for company X, but before we go any further, we need you to examine their software portfolio? And if they do that, how willing is company X often to allow you to do so?
We wouldn't always know if they were doing it for that reason. It might just look like a normal enterprise vendor type scan. Probably from a legal standpoint, they couldn't tell us why they're doing it. We do see a lot of the enterprise vendor type, that use case that I mentioned before. I would say that, you know, anecdotally, I don't hear very often of a very deep due diligence on the software portfolio. It's one of those things where it's hard to even get the list of applications sometimes. New applications are being spun up and down all the time. Most companies don't have a centralized list of everything that they have or everything that they're building that's up to date. When we go and onboard a new customer, getting that initial set of applications just defined and created in the system is often like a real chore. Now you imagine trying to do that in the middle of an M&A process. And usually there is like a software inventory, there's an asset inventory, but usually from what I've seen, it's not as deep as finding vulnerabilities. Sometimes it's looking at license risk. Sometimes it's just an understanding of like what components you're using. But to actually go through and do the deep analysis, that's a lot of time. It's a lot of money for a process that can't be slowed down too much. I'm not seeing a lot of it. I am seeing some lightweight security analysis being done. But again, that bootstrapping issue with identifying the inventory is not something that is really easy to fast forward.
It was interesting. I was listening to Brittany earlier, and she and I were talking about this challenge of how do you build this bill of materials, particularly when you're using open source components. And it seems to me that we tend to think of this as being an open source components bill of material, but actually we need to perhaps widen that conversation to say any component from any vendor, be it Microsoft or Oracle or IBM, if we're using a component, it needs to be properly recorded and constantly validated.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can inherit risk from anywhere. Open source has just blown up so much in the past decade or more. But yeah, people are licensing commercial components just as well, and those have vulnerabilities, and they get CVEs and vulnerability database, and we should be treating those exactly the same way. Maybe harder sometimes, because certain companies are definitely well known for, you know, having vulnerabilities reported to them and just sitting on them for years, whereas with open source, at least if something gets reported, I think there's maybe a bigger chance that anybody can kind of jump in. It's very visible that it's there, and you may get quicker results on that. But yeah, certainly you can inherit risk from those commercial components as well.
I think there's a lot people need to start thinking about there. Chris, thank you for talking to me today.
My pleasure.